The official Vintage Guitar Magazine 2025 Price Guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.
Hello, and welcome to Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. I'm your host, Ram Tooley. This podcast is about the joy of guitar. That includes buying guitars, selling guitars, collecting guitars. We're talking vintage guitars, new guitars, used guitars, pre-war, flat tops, electric Spanish arch tops, custom shop guitars, limited edition guitars, basses, amps, effect pedals, lap steels, mandolins, banjo. If it has strings, we're going to talk about it. I spend most of my life studying the vintage guitar market. It's truly something I love and I'm passionate about. I can talk guitars all day, and I'm going to. Hey, everybody. This is season three. We're kicking off. And when the rumor started spreading, people are pretty excited. I have in the flesh, Willie G. Mosley. How you doing, Willie?
Namaste from Hank Williams territory.
Let me introduce. I don't know if you need an introduction. If you're listening to a Vintage Guitar Magazine podcast, that means you probably subscribe and read Vintage Guitar Magazine. And if you do read Vintage Guitar Magazine, then you know the most prolific writer of all time, you know, he's like the John Steinbeck of guitar world, is Willie G. Mosley. Now, you began writing for VG in 1989, and you're pretty much the self-described stereotypical baby boomer guitar lover with a deep passion for vintage guitars. And you've authored 18 books, and you've written hundreds of articles on guitar history, mainly focusing on lesser brands, known brands. You talk about the luthiers, you talk about the cultural significance of these instruments. Your work is really highlights the craftsmanship and innovations of certain builders. Well, we're going to talk about those lesser known guitars, brands, but let's just talk mainly about how you got started at Vintage Guitar Magazine. How did you wind up being the guy that started writing articles for a weekly trader or a music trader magazine?
Well, yeah, the first article I had published was in September of 89 when the magazine was still called National Music Trader. I think it was Providence with a capital P that put me in the right place at the right time. In the spring of 89, we had just found out that my wife was pregnant, and I went to an Atlanta guitar show. It was the first guitar show that had ever been held in Atlanta. It's about 150 miles up the road from me. And I picked up a 16-page newsprint foldover thing called National Music Trader, and I had noticed that in recent, the last couple of years when I was playing in a band, a lot of the, even the budget models that I had come of age with as a high schooler in the 1960s were getting interesting out there in music stores, being sold as used items, sometimes for more than they sold for brand new back then. So I happened to pick up National Music Trader and had been, for some reason, working on developing my writing skills. I was a traveling salesman. I carried a typewriter in the trunk of my car to stay in my motel room and write at nights. I sent an essay about a 1961 Roy Smek made by Harmony, which I didn't know that's what it was then, because the brand logo had fallen off the headstock, and that was the name of the article, the case of the mystery Stratotone. Mm-hmm. So it was that guitar in that article. I sent it to Bismarck, North Dakota, of all places, along with a subscription. And about 3 weeks later, I get a note back from Alan Greenwood, you know, said it's just what we're looking for, send us some more. And say, I'm on the other end of the country down here in what I consider to be the heartland of American music. I think the folks in North Dakota like the idea that, you know, they knew somebody who could supply them with writing from much closer to the source.
Mm-hmm. One thing I remember, Alan, I did a interview with Alan last season, and he said, like, you know, in the early days, you know, they were trying to get ads, they couldn't. So they really needed to supplement this trader
Right.
With the stories, and you were perfect. You came in, and I remember I still have a lot of old tabloid size VG magazines, and your stuff is always is in every issue, right? Every issue, I think you wrote an article about something.
Just about. There have been some issues along the way that I've had as many as 5 articles in one issue.
Yeah.
It's not, like I said, there have been some times that I might not have something in there all the time. And we've got plenty of other writers, too, of course, nowadays. But it seemed like I got things started pretty much once. And it happened right around the time that Al opted to change the name of the magazine to Vintage Guitar. That was in 1990. I'd done a few articles, for 3 or 4 articles for him when I was National Music Trader. Then at the beginning of 1990, he changed the name and kind of changed the direction slightly as well. And then that picked up steam real fast. I mean, I ended up in my territory getting an interview like in late 1990 with Bill Carson from Fender, you know, who was the test pilot for the Fender Stratocaster back in the early 50s. Got to work my first guitar show in 1990 as well. I was back to Atlanta. And this time, so Vintage Guitar Magazine actually had a presence at a guitar show all the way on the other side of the country in 1990. So it goes back that far.
Now, you've written 18 books. Now, not all these books are about guitars. You've written about football. You've written about the space, astronauts, you know. And but would you say that the vast majority of your books about guitars?
Well, the astronaut book, first of all, the book was the family history of an Apollo astronaut, a guy that went to the moon. And I'm going to name drop here. Tommy Shaw from Styx is from my hometown. And he and I were reminiscing about some in a conversation one time. He said, well, back then in the 1960s, the astronauts were about as rock stars as it got.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Shaw's in a position to know. But the first books that were about guitars were basically anthologies of vintage guitar articles. There's a place for that, but that's, you know, once you get them out in anthology, the information about certain instruments and models could have changed dramatically after it's already in print. And I decided if I wanted to go for some guitar-oriented books, then I would probably be better to trying to write about something that has not been written about before. So that's why I wrote books about guitars in Bakersfield and Roger Fritz's Fritz Brothers guitars, including the Royce Buchanan
right
model, and several others like that. If I can do something,
mm-hmm. I enjoy your book. You and I, you know, we send each other our books. I write books and I send them to you. You wrote books and you send them to me. I enjoyed the Fritz Brothers book. You did one on Huckabee's collection. I enjoyed that one. I like collections. You know, I like looking at things and I like reading about the luthiers. I like things that are different, but I really like the lesser known brands. And I think for this podcast, Buy That Guitar, you know, I could talk about Stratocasters all day long. I could talk about Les Pauls all day long. There are a lot of people out there, they want to buy and play guitars, but they're not going to pay $20,000 for a vintage guitar. And some of these lesser known brands or these lesser known names are just as good. They're better. Some of them just as well engineered. Some sound even better. Out of all the guitars that you've written about, what is your favorite, like a lesser known brand?
I would have to probably say, it's a self-serving a little bit, but I would say Robin guitars.
Robin.
Off the top of my head, because I've got a book coming out on Robin. I'll go ahead and fess up about that. But even before I got the idea of doing that, I thought Robin was quite an innovative company with some of the instruments they were coming out with, but the instruments still had a bit of a retro vibe to them as well. And I've gone through several custom-made Robins made to my own specifications. Like my daughter's high school graduation present was a Robin Ranger in school colors. I just think Robin was a modern company that still had a good, nice little retro vibe to it as well.
Right.
So if you had to pin me down on one name, that would be, since I've been through so many of them myself, and wish I had a lot of them back, I would probably say Robin.
Now, they stopped production like 15 years ago, right?
2010, yeah, 15 years ago. They couldn't fix the crane back up again. There's been some changes in ownership. Uh-huh. They've established a presence on the internet again. And, yeah, they're, as we speak, they're gearing up to give it another shot.
I do the price guide. I do keep track of Robin. I know that they're pretty modestly priced, but they're great. You know, I tell people, if you're looking for these, you know, Strat type guitars that just play in, you know, Texas, a good Texas made guitar. They're in Texas, right?
Yeah, Houston.
Okay. Yeah. You know, a nice, great Texas, greats. They all play them. They all know about them. So that's going to be exciting if that comes around. Now let's, one book you wrote, it was called Bakersfield Guitars Illustrated. I think that was in 2021. I enjoy that book because I really like the makers, you know, the Moserites and the Halls and all those guys. They were a very unique bunch. They all seemed to be born in Los Angeles in the Rickenbacker mill, right? They all worked down there in Los Angeles with the original Rickenbacker.
Yeah.
And somehow, I guess it'd be the first one to go would be Mosley, Seamy Mosley, right? Is he the first one that relocated up to Bakersfield? Or
I think Andy, his brother, might have been up there further, but Seamy first got going in the San Fernando Valley near Los Angeles. And they were trying to evangelize, you know, he was a big, wanted to be a gospel singer.
Mm-hmm.
There were other relatives that were up there in the Bakersfield area. And they were basically, he and his brother, you know, the Mosley family was basically, during the Dust Bowl, were the people that migrated from Oklahoma.
Right.
Like thousands and thousands of others.
Mm-hmm.
To California, and Bakersfield was, like I said, had its own music scene that was developing, and then Seamy got involved with that. Seamy's considered the keystone, if you will, and all those other guys like Gene Moles or Bill Gruggett or Joe Hall, people like that worked for Seamy to start with, and then kind of branched out on their own. So he was the godfather, so to speak.
Right.
And I get asked this a lot, but I was probably kin to him. I did.
Right. They always say that you're no relation, but you told me that's not true.
Yeah. Well, we can't really pin it down, but I interviewed him 3.5 months before he died, and we established that we both had relatives that were from the Midlands of England, the English Midlands, Birmingham, England, where there's a lot of steel mills and everything. There's a Mosley district there in Birmingham, and it is spelled like his surname and mine. So we both traced family roots back to that area, so we probably are kin to each other, but I'll have to tell you this, he didn't offer me a kinfolk's discount on a Moserite base.
Even all after all you've done. Like the Standell Association, right? Standell was in South San Gabriel also.
Well, Standell was actually out, and it was an amplifier company that wanted to get into guitars. That was Bob Crooks.
Mosley kind of teamed up with him because Fender was showing that you got to sell the guitar and amp together. Yeah. So I think they partnered, right? That was like where it really starts.
Yeah, and he wanted, there were several different makers that made Standell instruments in Bakersfield, and Seamy Mosley was the first of them. And he was, I don't think Bob Crooks liked the quality of Seamy stuff. It was a little, I don't know, primeval looking or something. I can't think it'd be the appropriate term. But he, Standell did have a connection to him there. There was, this is how mysterious it was. There was one Standell manufacturer that went in and out of business fairly quickly in the mid-60s. And nobody in Bakersfield could, they remembered them, but they couldn't tell me anything about where the guy came from or who ran it. And the factory had been replaced by a freeway interchange. They knocked down the building to replace that particular factory. Those Standells were the last Standells that were made in Bakersfield. And they had some incongruities too. They had a headstock that was shaped like a bush axe. They had fiberglass, some of them had fiberglass bodies with no visible way to adjust the neck tension on it. And they were just really strange-looking instruments, but they were part of the history out there. Three different manufacturers for Standell.
Yep. Now, the interesting thing about the Moserite, you talk about the earliest examples. They're out there. People do have them. But it really isn't until he starts making guitars for Joe Mathus and Roger Reismeisen comes up, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I think that's where everything changes for Moserite, right? They take this Roger Reismeisen design with that German carve, and boom, right? That becomes kind of like the Mark One.
Yeah.
Correct?
And that was, you look real close at those very, very early Joe Mathus models, and they look like what turned into the Ventures model.
Right.
And the Ventures was what really put Moserite on the map. Everybody knows that because the Ventures are what baby boomers like me remember as the first band/brand association that we were called.
Right.
Because here's a band's name on a guitar headstock along with the brand name of the guitar itself.
Now, how did Noki Edwards, how did he connect with Mosley? Like, how did he, like, how was that? Because 1960, everything changes for Moserite.
Right.
So how did that connection happen? How did the Ventures get?
Gene Moles and Noki were playing in the same place up north, in, I think it was Washington State, Seattle area. And Gene had some experience, working in Bakersfield and would have future experiences there in Bakersfield. The connection was Gene Moles. Gene Moles introduced Noki to Sammy one time. When they went down to Bakersfield, and Noki liked what he was playing, and he worked up a deal with Sammy to where Noki would play the Moserite in concert and leave it sitting on a stand right in the front of the stage.
Right.
Guys would come up ogle it when the band. Right.
What is that?
And
in fact, if you remember the album cover, Moserite guitar, like the back of the album, always had Moserite.
You know? Oh, yeah. And
I think their fan club was right next door to the Moserite.
Yeah. And there was, and of course, it said somewhere on those photos, imprint, it said the Ventures play the Moserite guitar exclusively.
Right.
And
is that the first guitar that actually had the band name on the headstock?
Yeah.
No doubt. Okay.
The only other one I can think of that was a signature thing where the signature was the actual brand was, strangely enough, that Roy Schmeck harmony.
Yes,
and that was just a one-shot deal from about 1961. So it was about the same time, but those were comparing the Moserite to a harmony Stratotone, that's 6½ dozen of the other.
You think about our generation, like everybody always talks about, well, the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, but no. Us California guys, it was the Ventures. That was what I think in 1960, everybody was picking up guitars to sound and play like everybody had a garage band. Everybody wanted to play with a rhythm guitarist and a lead guitarist, right? And this is kind of where it comes from. And it kind of blows my mind is that the first two Ventures albums, I love them, but those are Jazz Masters and Stratocasters. And they get into, I guess, by the third album, now they're the Moserite band, everything Moserite. And I have like my top 10 live albums. In that top 10 is The Ventures in Japan. And that is a 1965 album that is probably one of the greatest rock and roll albums. Are you familiar with that album?
Is it called The Ventures on Stage or Ventures in
Japan? No, it's Adventures in Japan. It was their live
in Japan
concert in 1965 in Japan.
I may have had that one in the past, but it was, I think it didn't come out as live in Japan back in the day, did it? Didn't it come out later?
No, it was. I think it was Ventures in Japan, 1965. And what's weird is that this album was probably one of the first heavy-duty rock and roll albums, even though when you think of the Ventures, Walk, Don't Run, and, all the Perfudia and all that stuff. This, for some reason, there was some problem with the voltage in Japan. The amps were playing like with much lower plate currents or something, and it just distorted. And I think that's one of the greatest live albums. I think you go on Spotify and listen to the Live in Japan. And this is a 1965 album that has guitar tones kind of like the Who Live at Leeds. And to me, this was like, wow. And so after that, every kid in, well, that was like 1965, but 1961, 62, 63, I think you could buy a Moserite for about the same price, or a little cheaper than a Fender Stratocaster, right?
Yeah, they were a little bit more high priced, but there were some other factors too that one reason that Fender prevailed in any competition out there. For one thing, Mosrite didn't make any budget instruments, any student-oriented instruments, and Fender certainly did.
Right.
That was a big difference right there for a lot of people. And Simi, bless his heart, he was a good builder or something like that, but apparently wasn't the greatest businessman in the world.
Right. And I guess we'll talk about that in a little bit. Structurally, you know, because you understand guitar architecture, what made a Mosrite Mark One, or even the Ventures, the first couple years Ventures, what made it a better physical guitar than a Stratocaster at that time?
Well, the neck just played like butter, and the neck was thin, and they used real small fret wire for their frets. The flip side of that is you couldn't bend the strings all that well on a Mosrite.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a yin-yang situation there. But, they actually were pretty comfortable for something. Nothing else looked like them either with that extended lower cutaway.
Right.
And there's the Bakersfield book goes into detail, and I'm not going to do it here, but it goes into detail about the so-called legend about flipping over a Stratocaster and tracing it.
Right, right. If you look at it, that's the first thing you think of. Now, they also used much hotter pickups. Those things were wound pretty hot.
Oh, yeah, they were hot.
Hot. For that era, for a single coil. And they used that zero fret, which was, I don't think anybody was doing that zero fret yet.
Right. I don't know, yeah, back then about who might have had it. Some of the later brands used zero frets. I think even that mystery third Standell brand we were talking about earlier, I think they even had a zero fret on them.
Mm-hmm.
Hallmarks did. So a couple of others did. So zero frets seem to be a little more popular on Bakersfield guitars than guitars made elsewhere.
Yeah, and that's, I was going to say, here's a question. All these great guitar makers in Bakersfield, how come the Bakersfield greats didn't play Bakersfield-made guitars?
Well, I asked a guy who's been playing out there a long time, and Chuck Seaton, about that, and you're going to stereotype the Bakersfield music scene. You're going to think about the Bakersfield sound, which your people is going to think is going to be a Telecaster twang and drums for dancing.
Right.
And Chuck told me, he said, just the type of music we were making did not really avail itself to the type of sound, the hot pickup.
Right. You're not going to get a Mosrite to twang. There's no doubt. That is absolutely true.
Yeah, and he just kind of validated, Chuck just kind of validated what the stereotype was, that some interesting guitars were made in Bakersfield, but they weren't really all that much part of the Bakersfield sound. You can find a few pictures of some Mosrites in that Bakersfield book, but probably more pictures of more Fender guitars. And for that matter, Merle Haggard and Buck Owens both had phenomenal lead guitar players, Roy Nichols and Don Rich, respectively. They were Telecaster players.
Right. And, you know, when you think back to it, that's the magic, was that Telecaster.
Yeah.
You know, but I was just always confused that all these great guitar builders in Bakersfield, Leo Fender used to drive around and hand out his guitars all over Southern California. I was just wondering why these Mosrite guys weren't building things that were a little bit twangier. They could have, you know, but it just got them into the hands. But you're right, that's a whole different music scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I always, you know, so that anybody who's played a Mosrite knows that neck is a unique neck. It's a very fast neck, it's a very thin neck.
Yep.
But it's not a bothersome neck, not like a Blade, you know, a Gibson Blade neck. It's a very, it's just a fast neck. You could play really quickly on it.
Roger Fritz is a huge fan of Mosrite, although his guitars aren't really Mosrite style.
Right.
But he was talking about how the neck just plays like butter, and they were totally unique sound, and it was a lot of status among other musicians back in the 60s if you had a Mosrite.
Right. And you could get it for, you know, about what you pay for a Stratocaster, and you looked like you'd arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, too, that when you think of that signature sound, and all you have to do is really just listen to Ventures records that were made in 1964, 65, 66. They probably sold more guitars than any other band, right? As far as people wanting to play and sound like that. My grad night at was at Disneyland, like every other kid that goes to Southern California high school. My grad night was at Disneyland. The night that my grad night, I remember, you know, we were with girls. So the girls wanted to see Kool & the Gang because Kool & the Gang was the act that everybody wanted to see. I found out years later, like I was talking to somebody, he says, yeah, remember our grad night when the Ventures were playing at Disneyland? And I'm like, no. Like, I remember thinking like, wow, I could have seen the Vent, you know, because I, you know, they were always playing at Magic Mountain and that, but I never saw them. But I remember years later finding out that the Ventures were actually playing at my grad night at Disneyland. And I always think, wow, you know.
I'm lucky with some of the concerts I got to attend down here. I mean, we had the college that I went to, it wasn't my graduation, but just as part of the entertainment, we had the Allman Brothers there, the original six-piece, a month before they recorded the Fillmore East album. And we had Ike and Tina Turner Review, and I hitchhiked in 1968 to Atlanta and saw Cream on that last concert tour. So those times back then, anywhere just about in the country, there's some classic music being cranked out.
Yep, that's the I think that's the sadness of the next generation. They didn't get cool concerts.
So. And it worked, and creativity wise too, not just performance, but creativity wise.
Yeah, there's no comparison.
When I get lectures or speeches at colleges or conventions or whatever, I emphasize the point that, in my opinion, the most prolific and the most dynamic period of popular music in the U.S. was 6 years from 67 through 73. There's all kinds of genres, and like I said, I don't want to go off too long on a tangent on that, but you could list all the different types of music that flourished during those half dozen years.
Absolutely. And I think that's why they always say that, you know, we were lucky. Our generation was lucky. We made music before computers, you know, and it was just, you know, it was all about, you know, learning to play and wanting to play. And the Ventures were a huge part of that. And Mosrite was kind of a huge part.
Yeah. If you were serious about being a player, even as a teenager, if you were really serious about it, you would try to go on further from your Silvertone Dan Electro amp and the case model to something better and that you knew was a professional grade instrument. And Mosrite was right in there, you know, trying to beckoning your attention just like Fender Strats were.
Now, as far as, like, I think anybody wants a Mosrite, they're going to probably look for that Mark One Ventures model or a earlier one that was a Joe Mathis one. They're very similar. I guess before 1963, it would have been a Joe Mathis, and then that Mark One have been a Ventures model. What changes from 1963 to 1965 with that Ventures model? Do you know, like, specifically? Like,
I think, if I remember the catalog photo correctly, there's some cosmetic changes, and maybe the way the controls are laid out. I can't remember off the top of my head, but there were not many. And you could vary from guitar to guitar. Quite frankly, there's pictures of more than one original Joe Mathis that is in the book that shows Gene Moles mm-hmm. with them. And there's two different Moles' Mosrite, and the controls are different on them, the way they're laid out, I think. So right. Mosrite still was not a assembly line, you know, huge chugging factory or anything like that. You know, it was still had some, it was still small enough to where there were going to be incongruities.
Right.
And some of them, they're just being practical to use up a part or something like that.
And one of the things, you know, the price guy, and I know that, you know, you could get the very first model, the first Ventures model, the 63, you're going to pay about $7,000 to not quite $10,000, but, and what people want with these very first ones is that the necks were set. They were glued in. They weren't bolted in.
Right.
And did that change the way that thing sounds?
I was a bass player when I played, so I paid more attention to lower end notes and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. when the Ventures broke out, though, they were already bolt-ons for the most part. Well, maybe we should word it like this. Maybe we should say when the Ventures bought into the company, because you remember they bought into Mosley
right
for a while. And I think they were already switching to a bolt-on style. I would imagine the set neck ones would have had a little more of a fluid type of sound rather than, whereas the bolt-ons had a little more bite.
Yeah, that's true. And then, you know, in 1964, they introduced this Vibramute, and that kind of knocks the price down, you know, a couple thousand dollars, actually.
Right.
And I think the very first Mosrites that had Formola system, they had to actually dig a big hole, cavity in that guitar. And I think by the time they got to the Vibramute in 64, they could fix that where it was actually usable. If you're going to be doing the surf music, and you're going to need that tremolo bar. And then 65, you know, the price goes down a couple thousand dollars because they go to the two screws. And then 65, they have the three screws. They go boom, boom to the three screws. And that knocks it down. And then things get really cheap. Like, you can get a Ventures model pretty cheap from 66 to 68. Do you know what changed so significantly that it almost cuts the price by a third?
I don't know what happened as far as the quality of the instruments. I think was still all right, but they went to made some other changes that you think wouldn't really affect it. Like, I know the bass went from one pickup to two pickups, and some of the others, I don't know if they had any cost saving measures or what, but maybe they, I think on some of them, they, well, for one thing, they brought out a more of a student model, which was the little Mark V.
Yeah, or the Ventures II, I think.
Yeah, Ventures II, then Mark V.
Most of us know that Ventures II because that's what Johnny
Ramon
played. Yeah, everybody wanted one of those. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so everything kind of goes downhill in 1968. What happens in 1968 for Simi Mosley?
Well, for one, they went out of business. Yeah, they were having financial problems and trying to expand too much and trying to put amplifier line out that they were using on that. They did have, interestingly enough, they did have some success with a gizmo called the Fuzzrite. The Fuzz.
Right.
First on that, you know, so they did have some effect. Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's listened to Inagata Da Vida knows that fuzz, right?
But I tell you, the ultimate riff, in my opinion, with the fuzz ride was Iron Butterfly's first album, which came out in, I think, it's 67. Mm-hmm. And they used a fuzz ride on that on the last instrumental. The last song on the album was an instrumental called Iron Butterfly Theme.
Yes. Yes.
It starts off with this huge fuzzy power chord, and it's drenched in reverb, and that's Fuzzrite.
That's Fuzzrite. So somehow Thomas Organ gets involved too, right?
Yeah.
Do they sell to Thomas Organ? Is that what happens, or does Thomas Organ come in to save them?
Yeah, I don't think it worked out too long, Mosrite was having all kinds of problems. They were flailing in some parts. And the sad chronology of it is when they came out on Valentine's Day, the Blois came out on Valentine's Day of 1969 and found the factory doors padlocked.
Right.
So that was pretty sad.
So the Ventures, is that why they end their sponsorship, their deal, they tear up the deal?
They just couldn't get along with Simi. He thought his guitars ought to go in one type of direction for music's sake, and they were headed with the others and things. And I think Bob Bogle, the bass player for the Ventures, got out of the deal first, and the others did. But he continued to play Mosrite basses, and it kept going downhill though. And so they finally just. I'm going to be honest with you, when I first got a chance to interview the Ventures back in the mid-90s, I had to sell myself to Don Wilson to convince him that, no, I was not kin to Simi Mosley. I said, I may have been, but we never established that. And he you know, I had to, you know, kind of, I don't want to say do some fence mending, but I had to convince him that I didn't have any ulterior motive really or anything. So there was still some, I don't want to say bad blood, but there was still some mistrust there, even after decades. And that's sad, but that's the way it was.
Now, Semmy doesn't go away. He now, in the 70s, I think he comes with the gospel guitars, right?
Yeah.
And those were somewhat successful, weren't they?
Yeah, a bit, I think. You know, Semmy kept trying to come up with innovations and things like that. A while back, there was a pawn shop over in Georgia that had a brass rail on display.
Right.
And I missed getting that. I should have, 20/20 hindsight, jumped on it right then. But, Semmy never stopped trying to innovate. Mm-hmm. You look at some of his one-of-a-kind creations from later on, they're exquisite pieces.
Yep, the octave guitar. I remember seeing a picture of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've always been fascinated. And when we talk about other brands besides Fender and Gibson and Gretsch and Rickenbacker, I always say Mosrite, bang. And anybody who's, you want to pay, for a couple $1,000, you can get an incredibly well-built, awesome-sounding vintage guitar. And that's, I always tell people, look for these, when you see them, because you do see them. If you go to a guitar show, there's always going to be Mosrites up there somewhere, and they're probably a Ventures model. You just got to know, which ones are, why they're worth, the ones that are worth a lot of money, why they're priced the way they are. I don't know. I always been fascinated by that, so.
And like I said, I think any baby boomer guitar collector is going to have, even if he doesn't collect most rights, is going to have kind of a soft spot in his heart for them, because they were, like I said, associated with the Ventures just for 5 years. But that was an important 5 years in the American music scene, and it affected teenagers, quite strongly.
The official Vintage Guitar Magazine 2025 price guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.
Now, in the 1980s, all these American guitar manufacturers tried to reinvent themselves. Fenders tries to reinvent themselves, Gibson, because it's kind of like that era, the Japanese lawsuit era comes and goes. And it's kind of interesting that, everybody knows about the lawsuit era, Fenders and Gibsons, but there were also a lot of lawsuit era Mosrites, that Univox, I think they made a living copying that,
right?
That Mark One look, but they tried to invent themselves. But Leo Fender was gone, the Gibson McCarty was gone, but Mosrite was still there, and he kind of tried to reinvent Mosrite, but I don't think they really got much traction in the 1980s, did they?
Well, I've said that Mosrite was, in its business history, Mosrite was like a migratory mushroom. Would pop up somewhere, go in business for a little while, disappear, then pop up somebody else. I mean, legitimate Mosrites, semi-oriented or semi-associated guitars were built in California, Nevada, Oklahoma, North Carolina, and Arkansas. And so from 1960, well, let's say 65, because that's when it really broke out, with the Ventures and the guitar boom and everything. From 65 to 1992, you had it made in several states, and it just didn't seem to be all that stable.
Right.
Semmy said he had a decent offer from Arkansas, and I managed to get out there. He died in August of 92, and I got out there and toured the factory in December of 92, several months later. And they were looked like they were going strong to me at the time, but it didn't last,
right,
as it turned out.
Now, in the 2000s, another Mosrite company pops up, but that was a fake one, wasn't it?
I didn't really get into that into the book, or I didn't really do that much research on it either. If it was indeed, it didn't appear legitimate, let's put it like that. So I just stepped back from it.
Yeah, I just remember that, you know, there was like another Mosrite that came out in the 2000s, and people said, hey, that's not the real Mosley Guitar Company.
Yeah, there were different folks claiming the rights to the inherit the Mosrite name and the rights to build them. It was awful confusing for a lot of people. And I even managed to get up in, I think it was 95, maybe 96, way up into the Great Smoky Mountains down in North Carolina. I found Simi's gravesite, and they didn't even have a headstone at the time.
Oh. Another small brand, or another brand that wasn't so famous that had its heyday, was Peavey. Now, you were pretty familiar with Peavey because they were in your neighborhood, right? You lived really close to the Peavey.
Meridian, Mississippi is 150 miles from me.
Mm-hmm.
And Peavey was the first, I think. Well, I had toured Roger Fritz's factory back in 1990. Fritz Brothers was the first guitar builder I ever visited on, you know, to get a magazine article out of it. But as far as major manufacturers go, Peavey was in terms of, again, the guitars and amps and sound reinforcement, Peavey was fairly close, and it was a huge Southern success story. I like to say that Peavey guitars are and were the Ford trucks of the guitar business.
Oh, yeah. I remember reading a thing about Hartley Peavey. Like, he was a musician, and he would get into a band, and he would build their amps, and then once he got everything set up for him, they'd kick him out. So.
Yeah, he fully admitted that, you know, he wasn't all that good of a musician.
But he knew how to build an amp, and he knew how to, you know?
Yeah, he said that, you know, he realized pretty quickly that he had a better future in the guitar business by making amplifiers, and then later on sound reinforcement equipment, and then later on guitars. I mean, I can remember seeing new Peavey's in my part of the country, because there's a couple of music stores in Montgomery, Alabama, which is my hometown. And there were a couple of them that had Peavey amps as early as like 1967. The amplifiers were two-part cabinet and an amp head. And the head was kind of an angled front, kind of a wedge-shaped thing with large brushed aluminum knobs on it. And the talk among even your garage teenage musicians back then said, man, check out these Peavey amps. So I'm like, yeah, they real loud and they hold up. So even back then, Peavey was already starting to get a good rep for dependable equipment. I mean, Hartley, I don't care how many times you've interviewed him, he's, which I've done it more than once, but Hartley has got this mantra. He talks about wanting to offer quality equipment for working musicians at fair prices. And anytime you interview him, it doesn't matter if you've interviewed him before or not, he's going to get that phrase in there one way or the other.
Right. Well, you think about in the 1980s there, you could buy that T60 for about maybe half of what you'd pay for a Stratocaster, right?
The original list price for a T60 was $349 with a case.
Yeah.
And that's 78s when it came out.
Yeah. And that sometimes that case would have a little amplifier in it.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about, I was looking through the price guide the other day, and you look at some of these Peavey guitars and basses. I got still have a mint condition 1984 Patriot bass, single pickup thing, and I think the price guide was maybe $250 for, you know, that thing's about 40 years old now. Mine's mint condition, but it's a great little single pickup utility bass. It's American made. It's quality wise. It's only $250.
Yeah.
Now, you correct me on that if I'm out of line.
That's my passion, is always knowing what everything is. I'm always like, man, Peavey people. Like for like that T60 and that T40 bass, you know, you could get an awesome one for under $1,000, either one. nothing, you know, you think about that T60, that was so innovative for when it came out. It, you know, it had that tone shift switch. You had, that was the first guitar that was made with the CNC.
Yep.
And that was what, that's what lowered the price. This was the first computer CNC controlled manufacturing. You look at those PVs that, you know, we were talking about the space age. I mean, those things look like they were something that you would see in a command module, you know, the little clicks and dials and switches and just
a lot of knobs. I mean,
yeah.
And a lot of people didn't, you know, and this is something that Hartley and I have talked about on the record a good bit. He does not like to be compared to any budget instruments,
right.
American or Japanese. He said if somebody, you know, he came out one time with a little short, Hartley did, with a short scale solid body called the T15, which had its own amplifier built in the case, like the old Dan Electros. But when I was working on the Piggy Book with him, I remember he wrote to me quite testily, and maybe I deserved it. I had written about how he was came out with this. I said, Hartley admired Dan Electro, what Nat Daniel was doing with the amplifier built to the case, so he did it himself. And a couple of weeks later, after I ran that by him, you know, he asked me, he said, what in the hell are you doing comparing to me to Nat Daniel? I said, well, there's the amp in the case. He said, yeah. He said, but I feel like if my guitars weren't supposed to be the beginner's guitars or student guitars. They said there's first quality, and he said, I would run those why ads, you know, how come a Les Paul and a Stratocaster run for this much, and the T60 was just $349 with a case. And I've always felt like, you know, whatever you need Hartley was not making collector's items,
right,
either.
He was making workman's guitars. You know?
Yeah, and he, you know,
and
the point is, an average musician playing in an average location where, and this is full-time or part-time, the average customer in those average locations doesn't know the difference between a Dan Electro and a D'Angelico. Mm-hmm. And it's just whatever helps you to make your job go better sound-wise and playability-wise, that type of stuff. You shouldn't be fretting about too much about what other musicians think of your gear.
Right.
It's, you can please your audience or not.
One of the things, like, as I do this guide and I look at the prices and I always see PV, I always think, well, they don't get the respect they need. But if you're out there and you see a T60 or a T40 bass and it's $800, $1,000, you know, gosh, you're going to be blown away by this thing. But here's something I learned when it comes to PV, of course, the Van Halen stuff,
right,
is good. You know, like, people still pay a lot of money for the Van Halen EVH Wolfgang stuff. You know, those can be $3,500 to $4,500. But here's something that I did not know until my buddy Parker from Diablo came up to me one day and said, you're way off on your Vandenberg guitars. You know, I had them like where I have a lot of the other, you know, those kind of guitars, PV type guitars. And he pointed out to me that the Vandenberg Signature guitar and the Signature 2 were now getting big bucks. So that's that out there. If you just happen to have a Vandenberg sitting in under your bed, it's worth money now. But again, I always want to give PV the attention to detail. You know,
I've still got a Wolfgang, a PV Wolfgang, hardtail. I don't like, but again, I'm a bass player. But just a noodle around on the house. I've got this purple colored PV, and it's a hardtail, but it's even got the reverse toggle switch on it, you know.
Right.
And it's just a noodle around the house on, and it's in stone mint condition. It's from 2000, and I love the way that it hangs. If you're gonna just be play standing up,
right,
it's a real nice sounding instrument, and feels great
now,
too.
Yeah. Now, Willie, we talk a lot. One of the things we were talking about a while back is about our collections.
Yeah.
I want us in this, you know, the last part of this interview, I want to talk about our collections. And you've shared with me something about selling a collection or downsizing a collection. Would you mind talking about that a little bit?
As to why?
Well, no, I mean,
I don't know.
You have a very
I can do that.
Unique story, and I'm getting a lot of email from people that, you know, we're all at this age where our kids aren't playing the guitars. You know, I don't know. I get an email at least once every couple of months about, what do I do with my husband's collection? You know, what do I do with my collection? So I know that you and I were talking about this, about our collections and how we get to the realization that we do have to downsize. And you've done this. How many guitars did you have at one time?
I topped out at 97. And different people collect different instruments for different reasons, and thank goodness for that. But the way I opted to go was one of each, so to speak. I had, one Stratocaster, one Rickenbacker 4001 bass, one Les Paul. And if I found a cleaner or rarer example, I might opt to switch out. I wanted just a Americana type of collection, you know, ranging from Sears Silvertone, Dan Electros, amp in the case, on up through, again, Les Pauls. And I had a 63 ES-335 at one time, and, just decent, nice-looking, unmodified examples of each category. And that also included, you know, harmonies and Ks and basses and G&Ls. I always thought Leo-era G&L instruments, basses and guitars, were fantastic values. They were highly underrated, in my opinion. Anyway, I started collecting in 72 and retired from the day job at the end of 2015. And my collection was, to some extent, a type of retirement, but also a buffer as far as my employment went. I mean, there were some times where, as a traveling salesman, times got rough, and I had to sell an instrument or two to contribute my fair share to the family income. And I'm okay with that. I'm glad I had the instruments to do something like that with. But after I retired about 10 years ago, I started piecemealing it out as far as the collection goes, because, well, there was, you know, actually realizing that you're now over 65 and you're probably not going to be playing in a band that might be playing Madison Square Garden in the future. But there was also there was and still is some family health issues for not just me, but another family member as well. But for me, I'm not trying to sound maudlin, but I've been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and I can't enjoy playing them anymore. And so I might as well, you know, go ahead. And I don't think it's right for, if a guy dies before the rest of the members of his family does, that they should be stuck with having to haul around a bunch of guitar cases. You know what I'm saying? And my husband left me this, what do I do? Can I sell it? Because that's too awkward. What I did was, I've gotten a few left to, like I said, to noodle around on in the office when I feel like it, health-wise. But the rest of it, most of it, I sold out of in the last 10 years or so, and just put the money into a money market fund. And that's going to be easier for my daughter to deal with instead of a bunch of guitar cases.
You know, this era now, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of my friends that are dealers are saying there are a lot of people coming in with it's the widow with a collection, and her husband didn't tell her what it was worth. You know, there's that joke that I hope my wife doesn't sell this thing for what I told her I paid for it kind of thing. But they bring this collection in, and they have, you know, they don't know what it's worth. They don't know if there's anything valuable. You know, dealers will not cheat anybody. You know, the good dealers won't. But there's quite a bit of stuff entering into the market right now because these collections are being brought in whole. And there's like two things that I recommend is, A, you call, you know, in the Advertiser's Index of Vintage Guitar, there are dealers who buy whole collections, and they're honest and reputable people. So they will tell you what that collection is worth, and they'll tell you what they'll pay for it. And, you know, of course, they want to sell it for a profit, but they're not going to lie to you about what it's worth. They're not going to tell you that 59 Les Paul, there's, you know, that's not a real, you know what I mean? So, but I don't know. And then there's other options. There's the auctions. Do you know anything about, how did you sell your guitars?
Consigned them to a music store.
Your music store.
And also taking some to guitar shows, particularly the ones that we co-sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last hurrah for me, I'm probably not going to be going to any shows anymore, but a few years ago, the Amigos show in Nashville, well, actually in Franklin, Tennessee, was the last show that I went to, and I took some instruments that I never thought I was going to sell way back when, but I'll still sell them to dealers or customers at guitar shows, but I don't have any of those left now. The only real collectible instrument I've got is a Robin guitar, Robin Savoy, that semi-hollow guitar, and it's the only one that ever had a maple fretboard, and so it was made to my specs, and that's all well and good, but as far as Les Pauls or Strats, like I said, I've sold all of those, and I did them at guitar shows and consigned into a nearby store.
Now, one of the things is, I know, you know, that I talk to a lot of these guys that are trying to downsize, and they do know that they have to start selling off their guitars. There's a desire to keep this collection all together. You spent a lifetime putting a collection together, and you kind of want it to go to one person. That'll never happen. Nobody has your taste, you know, nobody's, and that's kind of the thing is that, you know, I know a lot of guys that have thousands of guitars, over 1,000. And one of the things is the value of these guitars. You know, it's really important that you understand or know what the value of your guitar is so that you aren't, you know, just so you're getting in the ballpark. A dealer is going to give you a little less than what the value is because he needs to sell it at that price, but they're usually fair. But one of the things, there's two advertisers in vintage guitar, the auctions, Heritage Auction and String Tree Auction. And these are...
Julian also, in
England, there's another, there's a lot of vintage auctions out there. I know of two that I talked to before I did this podcast. I just sent them an email saying, hey, give me a blurb so I can tell people what you do, how you do it, and what you do. And then, you know, the one thing about the auction is that you basically consign it over, but you do have some, you know, say in what the minimum is, and you now have a worldwide platform to sell that guitar. So, like for example, Heritage, you know, if you're thinking about selling, they told me, this is the blurb they sent me. If you're a guitar collector and you're thinking about selling, whether it's one guitar or a whole collection, Heritage will help. And they make the process really easy. You can reach out to them anytime, and they'll help figure out what your guitar is worth, the best way to get it in front of serious buyers. And they basically have a great platform that has zillions of eyes that look at it, and you know, it gets in front of real collectors. The only thing is, you got to pay. You know, there's a seller premium, and then there's the buyer premium. Seller premiums can be 10%. Sometimes they waive that, depending on if you sell a lot. But just know that you're already. And you don't know, with an auction, you might get your guitar that you think is worth this. It may only sell for that. You do take a chance, but it does go, you know. Heritage, actually, they let you, basically, you ship it to them. They do all the work. So that's...
I've used from articles. I mean, one thing that kind of needs to be emphasized with my personal situation, I've never done the auction thing because I don't know that I had anything that was so valuable. It needed to be auctioned off. So that's why I just went in and consigned them or sold them at guitar shows and stuff. My situation, as far as guitar income goes, isn't from buying and selling guitars or improving my collection. No, it's from writing. And I have to take a little bit different perspective on that because, you know, the writing thing is what has helped me out over the years more so than and buying and selling guitars. Now, just about every one of the instruments in my collection, I could have sold and did sell quite a bit of them individually, yes, for more than what I paid for them. But I wasn't in the guitar business. You know, it really kind of makes me kind of grimace or whatever when somebody lets me know, say, hey, I just found a Les Paul in a pawn shop. The price guide says it sells for $5,000, but I got it. And I go, come on, I can sell it for $5,000. No, you don't know if you can sell it for that or not. You got to actually do the transaction. Then you'll know whether you make a good decision or not. You don't have just by simply getting a bargain somewhere,
right?
Or a great score. You don't have that doesn't mean that you're hyper affluent about it either.
Right. And as far as String Trees, just a disclaimer, they actually they support this podcast. They advertise on this podcast. So,
right.
But I reach out. I talk to them a lot, and they're kind of the new kid in town. But they do a little different. It's another auction platform for guitars. You know, to them is they help handle it with care. They upload your collection to a public website that everybody can see, and you just put your collection up there, whether you're going to sell it or not, and then you're open to offers. You know, you can put your whole collection up there just to show them off and then see what the interest there is.
I don't have any experience or really know of anybody who's done their entire collection at once. And you would think that the auction house would be the way to go on that. I know there's more than one auction house that has agreed to let me use photos on articles that I write, and that's appreciated.
Right.
It's a little publicity for them too.
And then one thing about String Tree, they tell me that there's zero seller fees. So you put that up there and, you know, there's a zero seller fee on that. There is a buyer premium for buying, but I like their platform. I really do like String Tree. It's stringtree.co.
Okay.
I like them, and they've been good to me. They've been good to this podcast. They do sponsor the podcast times. So if you have a collection, and I guess the bottom line is you have a collection and you need to downsize, you need to start selling it off. Because you don't want your wife and children to have to deal with this. They are not going to know what it's worth or you know what it's worth emotionally, whatever. But I think once you sell one, then you can, it's easier to sell two or three. And then once you're selling two or three, that's, you know, so there is viable options. But if you have like me or somebody who bought stuff and you actually bought it as an investment, you probably got stuff that's worth money. The auction is probably the best way to go because they'll appraise it for you. They'll for free. And they'll set it up and they'll sell it and they'll put it in front of more eyes. And it's just, I guess it's premium you pay is really the more eyes you get, more international.
Well, the thing about auctions, that's just another facet of the phenomenon, you know, it's broken out because of the interest in it. The baby boomers are still driving the old guitar phenomenon, and we're not getting any younger. And that's why it may be the way to go with somebody, but like I said, I didn't ever really think about or consider about trying to sell the entire collection at once. I was having too much fun, you know, gooming out individually and stuff. But another thing that's a factor right now, and I don't know that I'm particularly pleased about it, is pawn shops. If they see more and more guys coming in looking for guitars, pawn shops thinking they're getting more stuff that's collector's items when it's not. I mean, I always tell pawn shops, you know, just because it's old and or American made and or, excuse me, not any made anymore, and like I said, American made, that doesn't mean it's collectible or a collector's item, or that doesn't mean it's valuable.
Right. And I think if you're looking to sell a guitar, the worst place you could take it is a pawn shop, you know.
Well, yeah, a lot of guys down here in this part of the country are going into flea markets now, and instead of pawn shops. So, I mean, even though I don't go into those anymore, I still ask around about some guys I used to, you know, who collected just like me, and they're peers, and we've been in touch for decades. And they say, some of them say, like I said, they're going into flea markets or thrift stores these days.
Yeah.
They'll find something every once in a while.
You know, we kind of just touched on this. If you send me any, like people out there, if you're interested in this and you want me to go a little deeper into these auction, you know, I could get the String Tree people on and get the Heritage people. They both said they would love to come on this podcast.
Okay.
And we could discuss it in more detail, like what the seller fees, what, you know, the platforms are. I know that you and I have been talking about selling it, and you had time to sell off your collection one by one, which is, I think, a great, because you know where everything went, you know who got it, you know they'll love it. I know a lot of people I get email from widows that say, I don't know what to do with this. And I kind of say, well, here's here's people in your area. I know where they live. Here's somebody in your area that, you know, you probably got some diamonds in the rough that they might buy the whole collection just to get those diamonds in the rough. One thing about the auctions is that if the auction doesn't sell that item, you know, that doesn't meet the reserve or whatever, it goes back to you. And that's one of the things where I believe Stringtree actually has a thing where they don't return it back to you. They'll keep it and try to sell it. I can get more details if we actually want. If there's interest out there and you want to learn more about these online auctions, let me know. Email me at ram@vintageguitar.com and I can pursue this a little deeper. I was just kind of always interested in this. And I think our generation is now starting to ask ourselves, what do we do with our collections? You know, I think we just touched on the surface here, but I know you and I talk about it a lot when we're chatting on the phone. And actually, I would really appreciate it today. I actually learned quite a bit about Moserite. And you're the guy, anytime you see a video or read a book about Moserite, they always quote you. They always list you as the most significant historian on that Bakersfield brands.
Right.
And I enjoy everything you write in VG Magazine. I think you are the most prolific guy I've ever known as far as how many things you write.
I'll keep it up. It's been over 36 years now.
I know.
Still going to keep it up. I'm still working on more.
What was that? Did you ever get, like, out of all the things you've written, what was the one thing you wrote that you got the most hate mail about?
I haven't really. Well, I can tell you which one has done the best sales wise.
Yeah, that's
the Huckabee book.
The go.
Yeah, the Huckabee. You know, one thing that people have told me by email and otherwise, several people said that they appreciated the fact that there's not the first bit of politics in the book.
Right. I love that book. And,
he
sent it to me.
He is a Huckabee is basically an average guy when it comes to guitar collecting. He's in a unique position because 2/3 of his collection was given to him. And
he keeps everything. You know, he loves everything. He puts it on display.
Yeah. And if he speaks someplace, a lot of times somebody will custom make a bass for him and they'll present it to him when he's there and stuff. That's a pretty interesting way to build up a collection.
I actually saw you on the Huckabee. You were on his TV show.
Yeah, back a couple of years ago.
And what were you wearing on your feet?
Yeah.
Did you have some kind of snakes, mongoose boots or something on?
you know, what you see is what you get with Huckabee. He's the same off camera as he is on camera. And I'm
you were wearing some kind of shoes. I was like, I think I sent you an email saying, what are you wearing?
Pythons.
Python, there it was. Shoes. Yep.
Yeah, it was Python. I got a Python shoes and Python belt and a Python guitar strap.
Yeah, I was like watching that video. I was watching that clip from the TV show and I'm like, what the heck has Willie got on his feet? I think I sent you an email.
More people saw those shoes than I thought would. The animal rights activists shouldn't get uptight about that because that's, you know, Python is that big bugaboo that's eating up all of our furry friends down in the Florida Everglades.
I know something about you nobody else knows. You're actually a movie star.
Yep. I'm not, you know, like I said, I don't know how well I quit my day job.
But you were actually in a movie, and you actually get quite a bit of screen time in that movie.
Yep. I played guitar in a Tim Burton movie that they filmed in my area. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of fun too. And it ran like interestingly, like the Huckabee show, it ran like a well-oiled machine. It really pros. The Huckabee folks and the Tim Burton film crew was.
Yep, that was fun. Well, Willie, I appreciate, I know that I kept you on much longer than I told you this was going to be an hour, but I just wasn't going to let you go that easily.
Okay.
We covered a lot of ground, and I appreciate everything you do. I enjoy everything you write. We have a good friendship going. We talk all the time, and I just appreciate that. Everybody who reads Vintage Guitar Magazine knows you, appreciates what you do. In fact, if I get a Vintage Guitar Magazine and it doesn't have a Willie Mosley article in it, I kind of feel like I got, you know, ripped off.
I'll keep it up as long as I'm coherent.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again. You have a great rest of your day there.
All right. Let's do it again sometime.
All righty. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Happy birthday, America.
Yep. Happy birthday. This is actually going to air a couple of days after we record it. Thank you so much, Willie.
That'll work. I enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Hey, everybody. Again, I'm glad to be back. This is season 3. And I wanted to tell you about something kind of exciting. Anybody who's actually reads my books, we actually did an audiobook of Naked and Dimes. So now you don't just read about it. I know we used to have the website, but now the actual riffs, the actual clips, the actual amps, you can hear these things in the audiobook. So the audiobook is going to contain all the different samples from the session. That audiobook is available everywhere you get audiobooks. The Naked and Dimed audiobook coming out real soon. I want you to invite you, if you want to hear what the amps used on Naked and Dimed sound like, now you can. And read the book as you go. The enjoyment is uncountable. We'll talk to you guys next week. Thank you for listening to Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. Please support VG for all they do for guitar players like us. Please subscribe, like, share, and comment on this podcast. I'd love to hear from you at ram@vintageguitar.com. See you again next week. Bye-bye.
The official Vintage Guitar Magazine 2025 price guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.